ॐ वसुदेवसुतं देवं कंसचाणूरमर्दनं देवकी परमानन्दं कृष्णं वन्दे जगद्गुरुम्. So we are studying the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Very beloved chapter. It's on Bhakti Yoga, so favorite of many people. Sometimes the only chapter people study, sometimes they begin with this chapter. Sometimes they want to chant the Bhagavad Gita, they chant this chapter. It's a very sweet chapter. Also, the Bhagavad Gita, 18 chapters, one way of understanding what is there in the Bhagavad Gita. Madhusudan Saraswati, a great non-dual master in the tradition of Shankaracharya, in our tradition, he has said that that Bhagavad Gita in 18 chapters, you can see it as the whole thing teaches you that thou art Tattvamasi. The central teaching of Advaita Vedanta, that you are that. That means that ultimate reality. Some of you are looking like, that what? So you are Brahman. And this is the central teaching of Advaita Vedanta, the so-called Mahavakya, the great saying from the Chandogya Upanishad. And the way he analyzes it is, the first six chapters 1 to 6, are about you. Tvam. In Sanskrit, tvam, you. Our real nature. Who am I? What am I? That I am not this body. That I am not this mind. That I am this limitless awareness, consciousness, which is the witness of body, mind and the world. Then the next six chapters 7 to 12, are about that meaning the reality of this, the reality beyond this universe, the God of religion, the one which has produced this universe, maintains this universe, and one day will again dissolve this universe. The God that religions worship, theistic religions worship. In Vedantic terms, Saguna Brahman, Ishvara, Bhagavan. And then the last six chapters, 13 to 18, are about the identity of that and thou. You, tat and tvam. That really, really speaking, just as I am not this individual sentient being, I am this limitless awareness beyond all attributes. Nirguna Brahman. So also, the God of the universe, that which is the source of this entire display which is before us, that also is that limitless existence, consciousness, bliss. It is one reality. You are that. The reality in there, this body and mind, the reality in there, and the reality which is the reality of this entire universe, they are one reality. That's the meaning of the entire Bhagavad Gita. Of course, this is from an Advaitic, non-dual perspective. And each of these sections, chapters 1 to 6, 7 to 12, 13 to 18, are rich, complex, many, many things are there. So this is, Madhusudan Saraswati is giving us not only the big picture, but the very broad picture. Just a sort of sketch. Anyway, the point is that what we are reading now, we are coming to the conclusion of the second section. The section about God. That's why, and there's some truth to that. Because the last few chapters we did, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, they're mostly about God. Then next, we will get down to some very deep non-dual teachings. 13th chapter. But now, we are at the climax, the conclusion of the 12th chapter. We'll do verses 16 onwards. Please repeat after me. Anapeksha shuchir daksha, anapeksha shuchir daksha, udasino gatavyathaha, udasino gatavyathaha. Sarvarambha parityagi, sarvarambha parityagi, yomad bhakta same priyaha, yomad bhakta same priyaha. independent, clean, dexterous, indifferent, untroubled, and discarding all endeavors, such a devotee of mine is dear to me. So these verses, from 14 onwards actually. Huh? So 14 onwards, 14, 15, 16, 17, up to 20th verse, all of them are answering the question, how to love God and how to be loved by God. How to love God and how to be loved God. All of these verses will say that madbhakta, the one who is devoted to me, so the one who loves God, one who has bhakti, that's one side of it. Then the other side of it is same priyaha, that one is dear to me. So we all are devotees. We all have some kind of devotion towards God, most of us. Some are very hardcore non-dualists. They may smile at all this God business. But most of us, we do believe in God. And we have devotion for God and reliance on God. But does God love us? Of course God loves you. God loves everybody. Even if you are not devoted to God, God loves you. True. But how do we feel it? How do we really understand, feel the love of God? So same priya, the really the one whom God loves, or we can put it this way, the love of God is manifest, clearly so. So that is being explained here. What do we need to do in our own lives? What do we need to do? Number 16, the verse we just read, anapeksha. So independent means, anapeksha means not dependent on what the world provides you. See, we go around with a begging bowl from the world. You know, give me some happiness, give me some love. Especially that's the big one. Give me some love, love. I want to be loved. Don't love yourself, why would anybody else love you? Can't be alone. I want to be with people. You can see the contradiction there. Can't be alone means you don't want your own company. If you don't want your own company, why would people want your company? So, anapeksha, not dependent on the world for handouts. So, the commentator here, I'm holding Sridhar Swami's commentary, who lived about 700 years ago. By the way, he is most well known for his massive commentary on the Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam commentary. But his Bhagavad Gita commentary is also well known. Very simple commentary. So there he says, the commentator says, anapekshas yadriccha upasthite apyarthe nispriyaha. Whatever comes your way. You can think of a monk. So whatever he gets in alms, in bhiksha, whatever he gets. Arthe api nispriyaha. Even they are also not attached. So not running after things and trying to get things for oneself, already attached. No, not like that. Even the things which come your own way, they are also detached. Not even attached to that. Then, next one is shuchi, pure. Cleanliness, basically. And commentator says, shuchi is bahya abhyantara shaucha sampanna. So, external cleanliness. And we all have heard the saying, cleanliness is next to godliness, yes, everybody knows that. So, clean, your surroundings are clean, your room is clean. So, this is something that was insisted upon when we joined the monastery. Your dress is clean, and of course, body is clean. And I remember in our training days in the monastery, we had to scrub and scrub and scrub. Everything had to be clean. The room was inspected for cleanliness. Our dress was, and some of us were better than others. I wasn't too good. Because as a novice, you have to wear white dress. And you have only two or three sets. And they tend to get a little dirty after some time. Especially in dusty environments. And some of the other novices were much better at it. I remember telling another novice, a brahmachari, who was a little senior to me, telling him admiringly and enviously that, brother, the dhoti and the shirt you put on for playing volleyball, that's your spare. That's cleaner than my cleanest, the dhoti, the one which I use for going to the temple. So some were better than others. I remember one of my friends, a very good monk, but he was not very good at cleaning his clothes, or at least, or not very bothered. He was very dispassionate. So that's a good quality in a monk. But our seniors always insisted on cleanliness. So when he was a brahmacharya novice, obviously you have to dress in white. I remember once in the monastery, a group of Germans had come. I think it's telling that they're Germans because they're very particular. So they had come, and one Swami was showing them around. And so the Germans asked the Swami, why are some in white and why are some in orange? In Gerwa, in the ochre. And the Swami explained, those who are in white are the novices. They undergo training for 10 years. Those who are in orange, in the Gerwa, that's the ochre robes, they are already full-fledged monks. They have taken the vows of monasticism. So then my friend was walking past them. And so this German asked the Swami, what about him? And they said, he's a brahmachari, he's a novice. Oh, why is he wearing gray? The only time he was forced to clean his clothes was one day he was walking past, and Swami Smaranandaji, who is the president of the order, he's quite ill now. You might have seen in the news, you know. Prime Minister Modi went to meet him, I think, last week. So he was at that time, Swami Smaranandaji was the general secretary of our order at that time. And this, my friend, was walking past his office, and the general secretary of the entire order comes out and tells this junior most monk, you know, may I wash your clothes? That's the only time he went. No, I'll do it. So external cleanliness. A good deal of our time under training was spent in scrub. Scrub your clothes, scrub your bed, scrub your room, the bathroom, everything. And it had to be spotless. And we had to do the cleaning for the acharyas, the masters who used to teach her. So this is part of our training, to clean their rooms. And some of them were really sticklers. So one master we had, he's passed away now, an extraordinary monk. I mean, he was famous for his absolutely precise routine. You could adjust your watches by the time he took his walks and everything. But he was very demanding. So for example, the doorknobs had to shine so that he could see his face in it. And they are brass. So my friend, he said, it's too difficult. You're not supposed to use, there's something called brasso. You scrub it, it becomes shiny. You're not supposed to use it because he could smell it. He didn't like the smell. One, my friend told me, I had to use brasso. I can't do it. It's too difficult. Yeah. So this Swami was really, I mean, there were incredible stories. I've seen it myself. So you have to, for example, this is a little bit of a diversion, but to just give an instance of what he was like. So one of the duties we had was to give dhuna, that is sulfur, or what do you call it? The smoke? And camphor? Dhuna, camphor, not sulfur, camphor. Yeah. So sulfur would be smelly. This is very fragrant. And it's meant to drive away the mosquitoes, of which there are plenty there. There's an ancient Sanskrit saying, Mashakaya Dhumaha. Smoke is for the mosquitoes, not for their welfare, to drive them away. Smoke is for the mosquitoes. And so this Swami, we had to give smoke there. And this Swami would, his test of how it was done properly or not, he would step out of his room and go to the window, and he would wait. His test was the switchboard where the fan and light switches were there, he shouldn't be able to see it with the smoke. And he would stand at the window and watch. When it became blurry enough, he would say, that's enough. But until that time, you have to keep on giving the smoke there. Then physical cleanliness and internal cleanliness. What are we, the levels, two levels. What are we seeing? What are we hearing? Especially seeing and hearing. Of course, smelling, tasting, touching, all right, that's there. So the input, are we ingesting dirt from outside? They have to be cleansed, clear about that. There were 2 years and when we were not allowed to touch a newspaper. And some of us got very curious about what's going on in the world. That was only, so there was a library in which the newspapers were put out outside on a reading board. So anybody, monks or the visitors, could go and take a look at the newspaper. I still remember, I had gone to the library, I was looking at some books, and a friend of mine went and peeked at the newspaper. And as his luck would have it, one of the masters was walking past. I still remember that. It's traumatic. He yelled at him, "Go back to your room immediately." Just for peeking at the newspaper, he was banished back to, confined to his quarters. So internal cleanliness. What are we looking at? And what are we thinking? So there used to be a subject long ago, before our time, but I've seen it, a syllabus called mental hygiene. So subject was mental hygiene. Mental hygiene, yeah. It was, I think, some kind of moral teachings or something like that. But it shows internal cleanliness. All right. Daksho analasa. So the next thing is not lazy. So I'm too spiritual to do any good at all. I mean, anything at all. A pastor of a church told me that in every congregation there are some who are too heavenly to be any earthly good. No, do not be lazy. I remember reading about Swami Akhandanandaji, who was a disciple of Sri Ramakrishna. He set up the first orphanage which we run. It's in Murshidabad, the district of Bengal, a place called Sargachi. So one of the novices, brahmacharis, he got a scolding from the Swami, who was walking past an afternoon, the famous afternoon siesta of the Indians, and it's hot and muggy there, so he was sleeping, taking a nap. And the Swami scolded him, "Don't just lie there sleeping, get up, do something. If you cannot meditate, if you cannot serve, if you cannot do anything, you know, go read something." You see, these are literal words. Go read geography, for heaven's sake. Don't just lie there. Not lazy. Even if you do something even mundane, like he said, read geography if you have to, but don't just lie there. Don't waste this precious time. And that can go to very great extremes. There's this Swami, again a story of Swami Akhandanandaji, he, disciple of Sri Ramakrishna. Where is he here? There, on this side. Oh, he's one of the 2-3 direct disciples whose video is there. So an American, trust the Yankees to do it, who visited in the 1920s, they took a film. It's available on YouTube. You can see. Just a few seconds of exactly Swami Akhandanandaji looking like exactly like that, sitting there in Sargachi, in that ashram. So he would sometimes visit our main monastery in Belur. Belur Mutt. Our main monastery, you would sometimes visit. At that time, the president of the order was Swami Shivananda, another disciple of Sri Ramakrishna. And the young monks would get the chance, the privilege of serving these elderly Swamis who were disciples of Sri Ramakrishna and all Brahmagyanis, enlightened. So at night, everybody's gone to sleep. And suddenly Swami Akhandananda comes and pounds on the door of Swami Shivananda, who is the president of the order. "Brother, brother, wake up!" Swami Shivananda, who hardly got any sleep at night, he said, "Yes, what's up? What's wrong?" He said, "Look at this young monk who was supposed to serve Swami Akhandananda. He's sleeping." And Swami Shivananda must have looked quizzical. "But has he realized God? How can he sleep? Brother, tell him, when we were his age, did we ever sleep at night? We meditated night long. How can he sleep?" And that monk was so embarrassed. And the Swami Shivananda said, "Oh, it's all right. He'll take his time. He will realize God in his own good time. Don't worry. You go and rest." So Swami Akhandananda went away muttering to himself, "Still sleeping at night. I never..." That's of course very extreme. And by the way, we do sleep at night. And very well, thank you. udasina pakshapata rahitaha, neutral, no partiality. A devotee should not have partiality with the people around him, nor for people who are good to him, nor for people who are not good to him. You should not have partiality. Partiality for people, it harms devotion. Gatavyatha adhi shunyaha, untroubled. First of all, not troubled by grief, not troubled by anxiety and depression on account of the world. Why not? The world is very troublesome. No, you're going to love God. How can love of God dwell in the same place where the cloud of depression, unhappiness, restlessness for the world is there? You have to drive it away. You're inviting an honored guest to your house. Will you keep a lot of dirt in the same room? Will you not dust it, clean it, make it suitable for the visit of the honored guest? Our hearts, if there is negativity in it, resentment in it, unhappiness, adi actually is unhappiness. Unhappiness about something in the world. Don't be unhappy. You see, that's easier said than done. Vivekananda said, no, a gloomy face is a disease. You have no right to carry it out into the world. If you're scowling and you're a gloomy face, shut yourself in a room until it's gone. You have no right to spread it in the world outside. Saint Teresa said, a sad nun is a bad nun. A sad nun is a bad nun. And I was foolish enough, faux pas, I actually quoted this in the convent with the nuns. And one of the nuns said, and monk too, Swami. I said, yes, of course, it means monk. But it just rhymes. Sad, it doesn't rhyme. They immediately thought I was accusing them of being bad nuns. A sad nun is a bad. So, adhi shunya. Now, what about real serious grief? Yes, it's possible. I've known people who have lost near and dear ones, and it's very natural to grieve for them. But then one must move ahead. If you continuously grieve and not get out of it, then it's a weakness of the mind. Drive it out. People will go away. Parents and grandparents will get old and die. Children will grow up and go away. Friends and co-workers will come and go. Your connection is with the Lord. You are a lover of God. God is always present. Why will you be unhappy? Sometimes it's impossible not to be unhappy. Life really can be terrible. Can be terrible. So grief is permitted, but only for a short period. You must come out of it. Snap out of it. Grief, continuous grief is tamasic. This mind, tamas, rajas, sattva, tamas is the quality of darkness, inertia, downward. Rajas is activity, dynamism, and sattva is purity, serenity and all that. So tamas, darkness, continued grief. I'm not saying reasonable time, certainly, but continued grief is a sign of tamas, darkness. Then Sarvarambha Parityagi, discarding all endeavors. Now what does this mean? Swami Vivekananda put it very simply. He said, neither seek nor avoid. If you don't do endeavors, how can you live in the world? You have things to be done for the family, for the job. Each week is a new project and new goals and all that. If you give it up, how can you survive? No, it's not. He's not telling you not to do that. But this continuous, this is rajasic. Continuously gathering more and more activities, filling up your time with this and that till there's no time and energy left for your spiritual practices. A devotee cannot afford to do that. You must clear the decks for action. What action? Spiritual action. So the commentator says, Sarvan drishta drishta arthan arambha anudyaman. So all the drishta means whatever is there in the world. The new projects, don't take up new projects. Adrishta means things about, you know, in those days, heaven. They would say, for heaven I will perform these Vedic rituals. And they used to be big affairs. If you're a devotee of God, you have to stop that. Bhakta has to be focused on God. The devotee has to be focused on God. You have to love God. It can't be a part-time thing. So unnecessary endeavors in life. This project, that project. Here, don't take it otherwise, but an ideal which is put forth again and again in life in America. I hear this again. My grandma is doing really well for her age. You know, she is 70, 80, and she is so fit. You know, she loves to paint and go out dancing, and she goes out on vacations, and she has these hobbies, this and that, and she has nowadays wide social media circle. She's busy on the phone all the time. In one sense, yes, it's better than being depressed. The problem, there's a specialty called geriatric psychology, psychiatry. So there's every chance of being depressed because of physical illness, because of loneliness, people going away. Then there's no job at a certain age. So it's there's all chance of becoming depressed and unhappy. However, it's definitely better than that to be engaged in half a dozen different things. However, this is not good. At that age, one should be spiritual. One should be engaged. Yes, engaged in reading spiritual books, engaged in maybe listening to spiritual talks, engaged in chanting and meditation, and if more and more internal practices like japa, like meditation. If meditation is not possible, at least japa. If nothing is possible, listen to bhajans. Or if you like to go to a temple or a meditation hall. So those are good. They have some point. Otherwise, this grandma is doing really well. She goes on a cruise to the Bahamas. All right. Better than being depressed, I suppose. But it's not a good sign. And that's often put forth as an ideal in this society, in the modern American society, because of the lack of a spiritual ideal. India also is changing very fast. But imagine one or two generations ago, if grandma was doing that, everyone would be aghast. Why? Sri Ramakrishna says he saw some elderly gentlemen who were retired from jobs sitting and playing cards. And he said, hasn't the time come to call on God? The hour draws close. The evening of life, shadows are lengthening. Isn't it time to call on God? So, then, such a person who is dear to me. Madhbhakta, this person is a lover of God. Yes, we are all lovers of God. But then you have to be these things also. Then only he says, same priyaha, such a devotee, such a lover of mine is dear to me. I love that one also. Question, how are we to love God and how is God, how will God love us this way? That is one. Again, 17. Yo na rishyati na dveshti. Yo na rishyati na dveshti, na shochati na kangshati, na shochati na kangshati, shubha shubha parityagi, shubha shubha parityagi, bhakti manya same priyaha, bhakti manya same priyaha. He who neither rejoices, nor dislikes, nor grieves, nor desires, who renounces good and evil, and who is devoted, is dear to me. All right. This requires some unpacking. Again, the same question. How are we to love God? How is God to love us? Yona rishyati na dveshti. So we have desires, things we want to happen in the world. You know, meeting a dear friend, getting the gadget of your choice, going on a nice vacation, good weather, good parking, all of these things. We want small things and big things all the time. And when we get it, he says, rishyati, we get delighted. We swell up in happiness. Isn't that good? But it's temporary. And it will come and go and it will always come with a reaction. It's always come with a reaction. And then, if we don't get it, no parking, the neighbor is awful, weather is terrible, the stock market went down. So he says, dveshti, we have aversion, dislike for these things. It's very natural. Likes and dislikes, very natural because of our desires. So our reaction of delight in getting what we want, what we like, and our reaction of aversion, irritation of the mind, in losing or in something that happens which we did not want to have. We have aversion for such things. And also, na shochati na kangshati, neither grieves nor thirsts. So something good happens. Then what happens? We want to hold on to it. It'll go away. And we want more of it. And something bad happens. We grieve. We are unhappy, anxious, depressed. None of this is permissible if you are going to be a devotee of God. Same thing. Sad nun is a bad nun. Why? Because this, the internal climate of the heart is disturbed, is polluted by these things. By worldly delight. What is worldly delight? The psychiatrist, the psychoanalyst Eric Fromm, he said, all our so-called happiness in our modern culture is building up tension and releasing it. That's our idea of happiness. Building up tension and releasing it. What does advertisement do? Builds up tension. And what happens when you go and buy it? You release the tension and it gives you some happiness. That will always produce a reaction. So that kind of a heart, which is always busy with the Amazon shopping cart, is not a good place for the dwelling of God. It's not a good place for loving God. Or disappointed with the people, disappointed with the world, disappointed with the things, how things are turning out. Again, not a good place for dwelling of God. You must be, this is called prasada. Prasada means, does not mean the food offering which we eat. No, the internal prasada means a wholesome feeling inside of peace, luminosity, contentment. Not this release of tension, not like that, not excitement. Shubha shubha parityagi. Apart from desires also, something higher than that, the good and the bad. Good and the bad also, you must learn to rise above it. What is good? Shubha and ashubha? It means auspicious, inauspicious, good and the bad. So the worldly sense of shubha and ashubha means when my desires are satisfied, that's shubha, good for me. When my desires are thwarted, that is bad for me. That was dealt with in the first line, the worldly part of it. Don't be excited when things go too well for you. Don't be upset and distressed when temporarily things are going badly. That's worldly desires. Give that up. Move away from that. Then, in spiritual life also, dharma, dharma. The occasion to do good. And that is shubha. And the occasion to be, when we are sinful, when we do things which are immoral, that is ashubha, from a dharmic perspective. Look at the difference. From worldly desire perspective, shubha, the auspicious, the good is that when my desires are fulfilled. Ashubha is when my desires are not fulfilled. From a dharmic, moral, ethical perspective, it's when I do good, that is shubha. When the opportunity for doing good comes, that is shubha, auspicious. When I do something bad, that is ashubha. From an ethical perspective, it may go against my desires. Are you seeing the difference, how it has progressed to something higher? My desire is to, get this thing, to enjoy this thing. And then I go ahead and do it. It might be, it is immoral from the ethical perspective. But it might be pleasurable from the desirable desire perspective. You can see the difference? So ethical person considers that to be good, auspicious, desirable, where I get a chance to do good. I am good. I follow my principles. And the ethical person considers that to be inauspicious, not good, condemnable, where I am not ethical, where I do something wrong, immoral, against principles. Or the situation is not conducive to my doing good. That is ashubha. But he's saying rise above that. Rise above that also. Does it mean you will become unethical? No. Ethical only, but not for the purpose of what is the result of dharma, ethical life? You will get punya, merit. And then what is the use of this merit? You will get happiness. Your desires will be fulfilled. It again comes back to the fulfillment of a pleasant life. See, those who chase the desires, they're doing it in an unsustainable way. They will get hurt. Those who are wiser, they still want the desires to be fulfilled. Those who are wiser, they will keep on doing dharma, good, and getting more and more good credit, punya credit in your karmic bank. Then what you want in life will also come that much easily to you. And the miserable things will be that much pushed back or suppressed in your life. So a more pleasant life, which everybody wants, you will get if you have done a lot of dharma and carefully avoided adharma. But that is not the goal of the devotee. You understand the difference between karma and karma yoga? Karma, good karma is, I have done a lot of good. So let me get the credit for that, let me get good karma, the punya, the merit for that. That is karma, that is good karma. That's a good thing to do, that is called dharma. But karma yoga is, I will do the good, I don't want the merit. I don't want the punya. It will come to you, but you are not doing it for the punya. You will get it anyway, but you are not doing it for the merit. Why are you doing it? As a worship of God. For the purification of the heart, so that I can become enlightened, I can really, really love God. That's why I am doing karma yoga. If I just do good karma, it is good karma, it is dharma. But it's not yet karma yoga. Karma yoga is higher. Ethical karma, even when I'm pursuing my selfish desires, ethical karma is called dharma. But when I give up my selfish desires, I'm doing that ethical karma only, not unethical. I'm doing the ethical karma only, the dharma only, but to please God, as a service of God, out of my love for God, then it becomes karma yoga. It becomes a spiritual practice. So shubha ashubha, you rise above the so-called dharmic shubha and ashubha. Now I am doing it not because this is ethical and avoiding that, that's because it's unethical. Of course I am, but something higher than that. I'm doing it as a worship of God. Okay, higher than that, shubha shubha from a bhakti perspective. What is shubha shubha from bhakti perspective, devotional perspective? There where I get to worship my Lord, where I get to do the puja, where I get to chant the bhajans, that is what I want to do. And when I'm deprived of the company of my Lord, that is what I want to have. That is ashubha for me. He says, you have to rise above that also. The externals, let me give an example, it'll make it clear. We have this monk, very senior monk, a master who taught me in our main monastery, but he was very devotional, very learned Swami, but also very, very devotional. Every occasion that he found, he would go to the temple of Sri Ramakrishna and he would render some service. We are supposed to get up at 3:40 a.m. You couldn't sleep after that because you have to be ready and ready for meditations before 4 a.m. But this Swami, he would get up at 2:30 a.m. He still does. 2:30 a.m. And he'd finish his, he'd take his bath and finish his meditation. By the time we were sleepily trudging towards the temple for our meditation, he was going and plucking flowers for the worship, the daily worship of Sri Ramakrishna in the temple. Very devotional. Very touching. One day I asked him, Swami, you are so learned, and he was in a very high position. I was teasing him. So this is something that we novices, we beginners do, arranging flowers in front of the deity. It's just like a physical thing. Why this thing? So why do you still do it? He told me something which is so touching. He says, if you do the least for the Lord, least thing for the Lord is so grateful. He said that the Lord is not ungrateful. In Bengali he said, Amar bishwas tini phelben na. My deep faith is that he will not discard me, he will not abandon me. It's a deep understanding. Really, Lord is not achieved by our Vedanta, by our meditation, even by our bhakti, devotion. How do you attain God realization? How do you attain liberation? How do you get freedom from samsara? By the grace of God. Everything else that we do, your study, meditation, your rituals, everything, coming to the class, it's all to please the Lord. That's all. Knock and it shall be opened. Ask and ye shall receive. He is the one who will open it. He is the one who will give it. You cannot grab it by your spiritual practices. So this master was, this teacher, he point, and that's what I understood. Anyway, this is all background. The story is this. At one point, the powers that be, the higher ups in our monastic hierarchy, told my master that, enough, you've been in the main monastery for such a long time, now you have to be sent to some other center, you have to take up some responsibility elsewhere. He was not willing to go, but then you have to obey. So he was sent. And where was he sent? He was sent to the one ashram we have where there's no deity, no devotional practice, no bhajans, no worship, no nothing. Advaita ashram. There's no temple there, there's no deity there, there's no worship there in the high Himalayas. You go there. And he suffered. He didn't want to. But he did, of course. He did go there and he did a very good job. And luckily, after some time, they said, come back. And he came back. So this is, you rise above the so-called externalities of bhakti also. Shubha, shubha, parityagi. Even when things are not conducive to your own bhakti, then also you persist in bhakti. You don't try to say that this one I will stay this way only and I will not stay that way. I will only worship in the temple, but I won't do accounts. Or I will do only accounts, but I will not worship in the temple. That also. I'm not much for rituals, so in exactly opposite case. I remember when I joined the order as a monk. So one of the things that we had to learn was ritualistic worship in the temple. Worship of Sri Ramakrishna in the temple. So we are all trained. And the monks, the head of the ashram, the monastery told me, learn to do the worship. And say, next month or something, you'll start doing the worship of Sri Ramakrishna in the temple. Now I was lax about it. There were a lot of other work. And so this I sort of let it pass. I was not interested really. So one day the head Swami asked me, how's your puja training progressing? I had to say, I haven't started yet. He said, next week, he told me straight up, I still remember, next week you will do the worship of of Sri Ramakrishna in the temple and you do it well, otherwise get out of the ashram. The gate is open, go. So of course I had to hustle and learn the puja and do the puja finally, which I enjoyed once I started doing it. So shubha shubha parityagi, your own personal preferences are not important. Then, from the jnana perspective, shubha ashubha, give up the shubha and the ashubha, auspicious and the suspicious. I remember there was an orientation for students when we entered. I was at a fellowship at Harvard for 1 year, so there was an orientation. They're all youngsters. I was the old man there. And in the orientation, 2 or 3 hours long, we were oriented into the latest gender ideology and all the LGBTQ plus and the power equations and all of that. We were given 2 hours or so. So, and in between, we were asked, how are you feeling? You have to talk about how you're feeling. And the guy next to me was very interesting. So everybody said, I'm eager or I'm confused or this is very interesting for me. This is new to me. But the guy next to me said, how are you feeling? He said, suspicious. He was honest, suspicious. The jnani, from the perspective of jnana, knowledge. Somebody goes, it's a rope in the dark, and somebody sees it as a snake. The other person says, no, no, it's not a snake. It's a flower garland discarded from the temple. Inauspicious, snake. Auspicious, the flower garland. Neither is true. It's a rope. So-called good, so-called evil, so-called high and low, pure and impure, one limitless existence consciousness bliss, which you are. Shubha shubha parityagi. Bhakti man, the one who has devotion, such a one who has devotion is beloved to me. This one loves God, and God says, I love this one. And then 18 and 19 have to be done together. Samashatrau cha mitre cha, samashatrau cha mitre cha, tatha mana pamanayoho, tatha mana pamanayoho, shitoshna sukha dukkheshu, shitoshna sukha dukkheshu, samasanga vivarjitaha, samasanga vivarjitaha, Tulya ninda stutir mauni, Tulya ninda stutir mauni,
santushto yena kena chit, santushto yena kena chit, aniketa sthiramati, aniketa sthiramati, bhaktiman me priyo naraha, bhaktiman me priyo naraha. Alike to foe and friend, in honor and dishonor alike, in heat and cold, happiness and misery, free from attachment, alike in praise and censure, reticent, satisfied with anything, without a home, homeless, steady in mind, such a devoted person is dear to me. People say bhakti is easy. When you read this, you begin to see the qualifications required for a true bhakta, devotee, is no less than the qualifications required for a true jnani. It's exactly the same. Sama shatrau cha mitre cha. Same, alike, even-minded, undisturbed, whether it's a friend or an enemy. Same, alike, even-minded, undisturbed, mana apamana, whether it's honor or dishonor. Same, alike, undisturbed, shitoshna, sukha dukkha, whether it is cold or heat, whether it is pleasure or pain. Same, undisturbed. What does this mean? Shatrau cha mitre cha, enemy and friend. We make a big deal about it. These are my friends. These are my relatives. Relatives is not a good word because relatives can often seem like enemies. So let's stick with the Gita. Enemies and friends. We make a big fuss about it. These are people are for me. These people are against me. This is samsara. This is samsara. Nobody's really for you. Nobody's really against you. They don't have the time. People are always self-involved. Very few people have the time to, like I have a project. These many hours daily I shall persecute you. Or these many hours daily I shall praise you. No, people don't have the time. We make a big deal about it. And this strengthens our samsara. What is shatru? And shatru means enemy. Mitra means friend. See, whenever we have, it's not external really. Most of it is internal in our minds. It's really in our minds. All of these problems, these dualities are mostly in our minds. Really it is the Atman. It is one consciousness, or if you believe that it's God. It's God in the hearts of all beings. God wearing these different masks, friend and enemy. Whenever we have this internal understanding, this person is my friend, we only see qualities. Those become luminous for us. Whenever I have this conviction, this person is bad, is an enemy, we only see defects. Think about it. Each of these people around us, there are so many who love those people. The ones we don't like, there are so many who like those people. It's been a lesson to me. Someone I don't like, somehow I've taken a dislike. Then I notice how many people like that person. I've seen again and again. I note it immediately. Somebody comes and praises that person whom I may not have a good opinion of. Then I realize, see, why do you think he's wrong and you're right? No. It's good. Do you dislike him genuinely from your heart? That person likes him genuinely from his heart. It's internal, it's in us. It's not so much in the other person. Swami Ranganathanandaji, who was the president of our order, he would say that in all so-called good persons, I see so many defects. And in so-called bad persons, I see so many good things that I neither praise nor criticize. Of course, he would generally always be full of praise. Even the least good, this is a sign of the spiritually advanced people that I've seen again and again in senior monks and devotees who are spiritually advanced. The least good in other people, they pick it out and they praise that and try to nurture that. They don't seem to see the faults. I have earlier used to find it irritating. I thought they were escapists, the senior monks, they are naive, escapists. No. It's my mind which is polluted. They are seeing truly. The so-called defects which we find terrible in others. See, what are the defects of little grandchildren to the grandparents? Nothing. The grandparents find them adorable.
Even parents might get very irritated. There was one psychologist in a group. He asked, suddenly a group of people, those who are irritated, annoyed with your children, raise your hands. Most of them raised their hands. So, for grandparents, you know, even the defect of the child is adorable. From a certain spiritual height, so-called problems are no problems from their perspective. The good points are something they would want to encourage. The Holy Mother, even the slightest thing, one of the girls, young ladies, she was able to wind the clock and adjust the time, you know, the winding clock. And the Holy Mother praised her so much, see how intelligent she is, she can wind the clock. This is a small thing, but no, you encourage, and you remember these encouragements. The small little things. And the defects are also corrected by them, I've seen, in the sweetest and gentlest way. Of course, it depends on the monk. I've seen some are very harsh, and some are very sweet and gentle. But all are your well-wisher. That I've understood. They're genuinely your well-wisher. So, often you will see, from a spiritual perspective, the person you consider to be an enemy, or enemy is a strong word, a difficult person in your life. Difficult person. Does you good. It develops, that person, he or she develops the capacity, what is called the tolerance. You know, Sri Ramakrishna used to say, Sha, 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 Je Shai, She Rai, Je Na Shai, Ta Na Shai. So it's a pun on Bengali words. Sha means to withstand, to forbear, to tolerate, to forbear the behavior of others. So forbear, forbear, forbear. The one who forbears, that one will survive, that one will gain victory. The one who does not, who becomes intolerant and I draw the line here. You see, the line will come closer and closer to you, pushing everybody outside on the other side. So that person, Sri Ramakrishna says, will perish. Perish means will not attain the high spiritual goal, will not even attain the things who are, people who are intolerant, they cannot attain anything in family life and in profession also. You know what people look for in companies? One very telling survey. People who can work with others. Can you work with others? No, I can't. They're terrible. This person is terrible. You'll soon find most people are terrible. They are not. They are not. I have become intolerant. Ultimately, companies are not really looking for very smart people or very competent people. That we can train you up to be. And good enough to get the job done. But can you work with others? Can you work with others? The tolerance. That's in the work level. In the family. That was Ma Sharada taught, you know, how to pull along with all sorts of people. Swami Vivekananda said, leadership, servant leadership. He says, the true leader is a servant to 1,000 people. The true leader must accommodate 1,000 minds. We think that I don't have power, the boss has all power. When I become the boss, then I will be good and tolerant. No, no, no. The boss has to, you know, the main thing that the boss has to do has to accommodate all of you. The leader has to accommodate all. That's not easy at all. It takes a lot of strength to accommodate other people. You have to sort of forget your individuality. You have to, you know, embrace everybody. That's a sign of a successful leader. And spiritual life even more. Sama shatrau cha mitrau cha. For the spiritual seeker, it is the same divinity in all these forms. Does not matter if this person is difficult, if that person is very easy to get along with. It definitely that is nicer. But often a friend is someone who weakens you. Enemy or a critic or a difficult person who is actually strengthening you in a spiritual sense. If you can withstand that. Children come and complain, little kids. About the parents. I always used to tell them, parents are your best well-wishers. Your greatest well-wishers are your parents. Except that they don't know the best way to go around it. So how to do it, they don't know well. There are unfortunately no training how to deal with children. But as we grow up, we all know,
Even if we blame our parents, even if we have many complaints against our parents, which modern American society teaches you to, all analysis and all, everything is your dad's fault, your mom's fault. It isn't. But we realize that they intended well all the time. That much is sure. They really are on your side. Except that the way they go about it may be quite irritating and annoying. I hear this often in public places and all. The most common thing I hear for little kids saying, boys and girls, "Mom, stop it!" So, shatrucha mitrecha, manapamanayoho, honor and dishonor. Yet we, especially spiritual seekers, have to be particularly careful about honor and dishonor. Because, as I said, fame is the last infirmity of a noble mind. So, people honor me, people like me, that's an infirmity. The more honor you get, what happens? All your good karma is being exhausted. The more dishonor you get, the more criticism you get, what happens? All your bad karma is being exhausted. When Swami was being criticized by a younger monk, and others were very annoyed, they said, "Why don't you tell him something?" And Swami, here, very, very gentle way of speaking, I just heard this story, I never saw it myself. He said, "Why should I? He's doing me a great favor. By criticizing me, he's destroying my bad karma. And he's taking it upon himself. So much bad karma he's taking for doing this service for him." Mana apamanaya. Yeah. Treat it alike. If it's a language you do not know, language of the birds, that the birds are cursing you, or they think you're singing very sweetly. No, they might be cursing you. But you don't understand it. So it's all very nice. Just look at it that way. Words have no power of their own at all, except the power that we give them. Who was that? Eleanor Roosevelt? She said, "Nobody can hurt you without your permission." All the time. He said, "No, Swami, they behave so badly. They say harsh things and nasty things." But that nasty thing, they may have said it. They may have done things against you. It's only when it comes to your knowledge and then comes to your mind and you give yourself permission to be unhappy, then you are unhappy. Buddha, there was this merchant who mocked him and insulted him. Buddha remained calm. And then the merchant got wild. And then finally he calmed down and he said, "Why didn't you get angry when I said all those things?" He said, "Because I didn't accept them. They returned to you." Shitoshna sukha dukkheshu. Same in heat and cold, in pain and in pleasure. Heat and cold. See, India is a hot country. And we look up, always think about the yogis sitting in the Himalayas and meditating. And we always have this feeling of, you know, how could they meditate in such severe cold? We couldn't be able to withstand it. But there's, I have seen yogis who have, they cannot withstand the heat of the plains. Whether it is inability to withstand heat or inability to withstand cold, both are signs of intolerance. Both are physical luxuries, basically. It's body identification. You cannot be a jnani, you cannot be a bhakta if you are given to such, if the body makes you dance around with the slightest discomfort. I went back to India last time before last, in Delhi. It was cold, but not really all that cold. And remember, in India, it's the houses, rooms are the same temperature as outside. If it's cold outside, it's cold inside. Your bed is also cold. If it's hot, it's hot outside and maybe just a little cooler inside. You don't have the continuous air conditioning all the time. See how it conditions us. Early in the morning, I put on a jacket and I went to the temple. Then I went to breakfast. And the Swami was wearing just a shirt and said, "You're surprised. You've come from America, but you're feeling cold here." It's true. Because of living in temperature-controlled environments, in the house, in the car, in the office, our bodies get used to it and we become oversensitive to little variations in temperature. It shouldn't be. Train the body to accept a few degrees higher or lower. I remember this monk who was very hot.
And Bengal is not only hot, but also humid. 100 degrees in the shade and 100% humidity. Somebody said, it's like walking through hot soup. It was. And you get drenched all the time. So this young monk, he said, oh, I can't bear it. It's terrible. I want to go to the mountains, you know. And so he went and asked for leave. We can do that. We can ask for some time off for going to, you know, mountains or pilgrim places to meditate and all that. So he went and told the general secretary, Swami, please grant me a few weeks of leave. I shall go to the Himalayas. He said a particular Himalayan ashram. It's an ashram called Mayavati, established by Swami Vivekananda. It's very cool and pleasant in summer also. I'll go there. And Swami said, oh, that's good. All right, you can go there. And this young monk, he told me later, this is the whole story, he said, my mistake was when he said yes, I was so relieved. I said, thank you, Swami, I'm looking forward to it. This is just too hot, I can't bear it here. And the Swami said, what? That's the reason you're going to the Himalayas? Look at these old and sick monks who are staying in these rooms, and they are able to suffer through this heat. Look at the poor person on the street who's drawing a rickshaw, working out. Thousands and thousands of people are living here. They don't have the option of, you know, going off to the Himalayas because it's cooler there. And then he said, "Is this why you became a monk? Go back home." So luckily he was not driven away from the monastery. It happens occasionally. Literally thrown out of the gate. So he came back. He got a shock. He said, I should have just kept my mouth shut. He gave me leave to go to the mountains and that's it. And then the Swami told him, yes, you see, I'm going to go there to meditate, spend a few weeks in silence and in retreat. That's good. But just because it's hot here. And the opposite. There I've seen monks who will not come down to the plains because it's too hot. So too hot, too cold. No, this is the body. Body is making you dance. Don't do that. And same with pleasure and pain. What is this pleasure and pain? Krishna said at the very beginning, second chapter, when he said you are the Atman. Yes, all right, I'm the Atman, I'm not born with the birth of the body, I do not die with the death of the body. Then Arjuna's question was, that's all right. But what about the pleasures and pains, the problems in life? Disease and hunger and, disappointment, physical problems, mental problems which keep coming. What about that? Krishna says, can't help you. Tan titikshasva, put up with them. Those will keep coming. There's no way around them. You can manage them skillfully at the most, but you cannot stop them from... As long as you're alive with the body, these things will keep coming by your own past karma. What is his advice? His advice is tan titikshasva. Put up with them, forbear with them. Yes. Tulya ninda stuti mauni. So, sangha vivarjitaha. Free of attachment. I remember you have a question, right? And I'll come to you. So free of attachment. Attachment to people, to places, to activities. Later on will come aniketa, homeless. Next the word will come. See, a spiritual person should not be attached to other persons, places, even ideas. The only thing a spiritual person should be attached to is God. A devotee should be attached to God. Nothing else. Nothing else. Everything else will be stripped away from us. So Swami Vivekananda says, give, give, for it shall be taken from you. It's better to give. One Swamis are always after donations. So Swami, he wanted a donation for an ashram. And this person was a very rich person, did not give. And then a few days later suffered a terrible financial loss, lost millions of dollars. And then the Swami was telling me, you know, he could have given that to me, that amount he lost. It could have gone to the ashram instead of just being wasted in the, you know. Anyway, so it will all go away. So do not be attached, do not be sticky. Nothing is attached to us. People are not attached to us. Things are not attached to us. Wealth is not attached to us. Health is not attached to us. It's all flowing. We get sticky. We try to hold on to it. Sangha Vivarjita. You are this pure, limitless consciousness blazing forth everywhere. Why be attached to a particular place? Now, Vivekananda tells Turiyananda. In those days, when they come to the United States, he said, forget India. Banish the memory of India also from your mind. Stay here and work. The mother has shown me a lot of work will be done in this country if you stay here. He told Swami Turiyananda. He sent him to California. Now, Turiyananda just said, why bring the Divine Mother into it? You want me to stay here. Why don't you say that? Vivekananda said, no. It's a direct communication from the Divine Mother. Well, Turiyananda didn't agree. He came back to India. But later on, he regretted it. Later on, he regretted it seriously. Yeah. So, yes, I have this feeling, kind of attachment for India. But this is, for a spiritual person, even this is difficult. It has to be overcome. If you're saying all places are the same, all people are the same divinity everywhere, then you must also drive away particular attachments. Not for everybody, but Swami Asheshanandaji, one interesting thing, some of you have seen him. So, he was the last living monastic disciple of Ma Sharada. He was the head of our Portland ashram. And now, even now, they consider the Portland ashram is very interesting. They have an atmosphere there, it's mother's ashram, because everything was, it's like hers. He did not want to come to this country. But they said, order is an order, you have to come. So he came. This was in the 1940s or something like that. He came. And he never ever went back to India till the end of his life. It must have been difficult for him, but he did not. So Aniketa, homeless, does not mean literally that you have to be on the streets. Your home should be in God. Your home is in God. Yes, if we had a question.
Yes. So maybe my question is, you just described...
I'll repeat the question, doesn't matter. It's all right. Yes.
So you just said that whether it's pain or pleasure, whether it is fame or dishonor, that you have to have a state of mind where you're not affected by either.
Yes.
Does that come, that equanimity of mind is a result of spiritual advancement, or is it a training of the mind?
Is it a training of the mind to have this equanimity, or is it the result of spiritual advancement? Both. We have to make an effort not to let our minds be upset. All of this is to prevent the mind from being upset. Don't let the mind be upset. Try. You will not succeed. The mind will be upset. But as we try, more and more evenness of mind will come. More and more equanimity. And look at it this way. You know, Gita, Vedanta, even if you set all these aside, these are basically things which we call maturity. This emotional maturity. Even without being spiritual, a person can have a little bit of all of these qualities. And we'll all like such people. So it comes as a result of our effort. That's what Krishna is telling us to do. But yes, you are right. Really it comes through spiritual advancement. Some kind of realization. Then you have a reality beyond these things, heat and cold, pleasure and pain, friends and enemies. You have got something higher than that. You have got something. From that perspective, it becomes very easy to rise up. But that's at a higher level. Ramana Maharshi, I give the example sometimes. Somebody wrote an article against him and sent him a copy. He corrected the grammar and the spelling and sent it back to him. Somebody said, but he is writing against you and publishing in the newspaper. He said, no, he's writing against some fellow called Ramana. He has no identification with the personality at all. And what he has identification with, that limitless consciousness, is also the critic. Tulya Ninda Stutir Mauni. Praise and... So we have run out of time. I'll do this a little better next time then. So 19 and 20 we'll finish next time and then move on. Om Shanti 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 hari om tat sat shri ram krishna arpanamastu. Well, they take the basket around. If anybody wants to comment or ask a question, you can raise your hand. You have a follow up? Yeah. Yes. Instruction or advice how to practice this equanimity of mind. Yes. The centeredness in God. God is in my heart. I will not upset my heart. I will not pollute my heart with grief or anger or restlessness or desires. I'll keep it peaceful and wholesome because God resides there. The other people, God resides in them. Really, they are not my enemies. Really, they are not my friends also. God alone exists there. So my connection with them is a divine connection. Identification. Home, country, it's all good. And it's good for development, character building. It's just, you should be identified with your home and your family, then your community, then your nation. Good, but also rise above it. Aniketa. So both ways. One is focusing on the divinity gives you this equanimity. And also as a practice, don't let anything disturb the equanimity of your mind. Don't let anything disturb the serenity of mind. This don't let anything disturb the serenity of mind, it's a practice in itself. You'll see it will require immediate effort. The moment you walk out of here, it'll take immediate effort. At every moment, there are things which can irritate us, which can excite us, which can scare us. No. Equanimity. Peace. Peace within. There is one limitless existence consciousness here, right now. It is so blazingly obvious all the time. It's amazing that we don't see it. And when you see it, like somebody, Swami Brahmananda said about Sri Ramakrishna, he's a visitor from the land that knows no night. It's a visitor from the land of eternal light. Where is the land of eternal light? Here. Where is that which knows no night? Here. When you see it, I mean, it is so visceral, it's like with a physical force it hits you. What an amazing thing it is. Sri Ramakrishna said, when he saw it, he said, I couldn't close my eyes. I would try to close the physical eyes. I've seen pictures of yogis with bright, blazing eyes, you know, staring. They can't close their eyelids also. That sounds horrible. But for a while, then you sort of get it under control. Imagine, limitless awareness. That is always blazing forth. But then when you first begin to realize it, your mind comes to the fullest of attention and keenness. Your nerves and your body also become surcharged with it for a while until you get it. Otherwise, you won't be able to sleep. He literally couldn't close his eyes. Yeah. I know about, I'll come to you, that will be the last question and we'll wrap it up. I know about this Swami. This is some extraordinary powers. He was in Banaras and one Swami told me who had seen this. He was a disciple of the Holy Mother and they considered him enlightened. Always luminous, full of joy like a child and shining eyes. He had to have an operation performed and they gave him anesthesia, chloroform or something in those days. He wouldn't lose consciousness. And then the anesthesiologist begged him, Swami, please lose consciousness. We have to operate. And then he giggled like a child and then went into lost consciousness. So there is something higher than the body, something higher than the sensory system, something higher than the mind. If you have control over the sensory system, you have tremendous control over the body. If you have control over the mind, you have tremendous control over the sensory system and the body. But if you have realized that which is beyond the mind, it's It's not that everyone who's enlightened will do these things, or the eyes will not close or something like that. But these are effects. It's a, like a side effect or a spin-off. Some strange things happen. Tremendous things you can sometimes see in the initial stages of a breakthrough. Then the person gets it under control and becomes more normal. The last question, yes. Tell us your name and ask the question.
Pranam Swamiji. My name is Prasoon. I just was wondering if you could explain more about equal to enemy and friend, because in the context of this, they're fighting a war. So I'm sure they're seeing everyone as their enemy. But how does that relate
yes.
to this verse?
So when you see others as enemies, I've heard, you know, reading stories of soldiers and airmen who fought in the Second World War, they didn't have any special hatred for the enemy. They sort of felt, often soldiers don't. Professional soldiers, they feel that the other guy is also doing a job, I'm doing a job. It's unfortunate that we have to fight. So there's no hatred there, often. So you have to do a job. Remember, this Gita is being taught in a battlefield. You're asking about war going on, people hating each other. This Gita is taught in a battlefield. And in the battlefield, Krishna is saying, your friends and your enemies, treat them equally. So from that perspective, but how do you do it? What do you do in life? You still have to fight the battle. This is the interesting thing. Internally, you know it's the one reality. But if you have to fight the battle, you have been put in that situation, you have to do it. Without any hatred, without any malice, without any sense of, I am threatened, so I will destroy you. No, I am not threatened at all by you. In fact, I and you are the one, same one. Then after knowing that also, I'm going to pump you full of arrows. If you don't come to the side of dharma, of righteousness. If that's your duty, it may not be your duty. Why just war? In an ashram. I told you, some of the swamis are very strict in correcting those who are, if they're going on the wrong path, if they're harming their own spiritual life, or they're disturbing the ashram, doing something wrong. Yes, they have to be corrected, whether gently or harshly, strictly. How will you scold God? You know, it's one consciousness, the divinity resides there. Yes, you can scold God. If that's the seva God wants, if that is the service that God wants, the puja, the worship that God wants. It sounds strange and weird. No, it isn't. It sounds strange and weird because we are looking at it in personal terms. I'll never fight with my friend. But it so happens that people do fight with their friends also. I can never love my enemies. So happens people after some time they lose their enmity and become fast friends also. It's happened. Nothing is constant here. So therefore it's much better not to harbor those deep feelings of animosity or unnecessary attachment to anybody. And just see the divinity in all beings and act skillfully. And if that skillful acting means that you have to go out and fight against enemies and terrorists and all, you have to do it. You have to do it. If it means that you have to be an activist, protesting against the war, you have to do it. If that's your understanding, good, why not? But you have to have the courage of doing that also. I learned a new word. Activist I had learned. Now there's a new word. Clicktivist. Clicktivist is who is an activist but doesn't go out and do anything outside. Just clicks on the an online activist. It's a clicktivist. All right. On that nice note, take care everybody. Yes.